welcome to episode 67 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I am joined by Thomas Arnett, educational researcher for the Christensen Institute and former middle school math teacher. Thomas is focused on disruptive change in K-12 education, and I recently heard him on the 10-Minute Teacher Cast with former guest Vicki Davis, where he talked about his research into instructional change. In that research, he connects the jobs to be done theory with educators adopting new practices, and I was fascinated, so I asked him to be on the show. Thomas and I talk about the positive side of the slow pace of change, his research on teachers accepting and buying into change, students slipping through the cracks because the system isn't meeting their needs, benefits of varied and innovative instructional models, the relationship between a school board and the district, why teachers need a different lens when thinking about technology in the classroom, how technology can and can't replace teachers, and how a great teacher can make you do things you love. So, sit back and enjoy episode 67 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Thomas Arnett. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler. I'm really excited today because I recently listened to an episode of Vicki Davis's 10-Minute Teacher Cast in which she talked to an educational researcher at the Christensen Institute. I guess I shouldn't try to talk that fast. And he talked about an article or a paper he wrote with a couple other people about the teacher's quest for progress. And it gave such an interesting perspective on pushing forward change in a classroom that I thought he would make a great guest for my show to talk a little bit about education. And so I reached out and Thomas Arnett agreed to join me on the show. So thank you so much for joining me. Thomas, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brad. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to have you on here. I'm really pumped we were able to line it up and fairly quickly. I think I reached out to you like end of last week, so we're able to line something up pretty quickly, which is nice. So that's great. But for anybody that did not hear the 10-Minute Teacher Cast episode or does not know who you are, could you just do a little intro for yourself?
Sure. So I'm Thomas Arnett. I am a senior research fellow at the Clayton Christensen Institute. And if you haven't heard of us, we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that was founded by a Harvard professor who studies innovation and has taken that research and founded our institute to look at different areas where there's challenges in the social sectors. So things like education, healthcare, developing economies, and the basic lens that we bring is how does innovation theory help us understand potential solutions to some of the tough challenges in these sectors. So I work in our education team looking at what does the future of education look like with things like blended learning, online learning happening, how do those things affect teachers and the teaching profession? And my background that kind of led me to this work was that I was a middle school math teacher in Kansas City, Missouri, and as a teacher often felt frustrated by some of the challenges that I faced where I felt like I couldn't really meet the needs of my students or reach all my students, in part because the way education worked in our district just wasn't set up to let me do what I felt like I needed to do for my students. And so I got into this work to figure out, well, how can we improve the education system so that teachers can make more of a difference and so that we can, better meet the needs of students and better serve our students. And that's what led me to the Institute.
I think probably a lot of us in education have had that moment where we feel like, something is in the way preventing us from doing what we think is best for kids. I mean, would you agree just in general that that's probably true?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt that. And I would say most, if not all teachers I've ever talked to have felt that in one way or another. And I think we keep doing the work we do as educators. Because it's important and we know that, kids need us and we need to make a difference for in their lives. But sometimes there's just structural barriers and constraints just in the way that education has been set up for the last, close to 100 years that it's just problems in the system that make it really hard to do what you think is best for kids or to make the difference you want to make.
So let me ask you, in your role now, do you feel like the work you're doing is leading to change and positive change for kids? That do you feel that direct of a connection? Because I think when I think about leaving the classroom, it's something I worry about is not feeling that connection.
Well, candidly, it is a little bit indirect. The role that I sit in right now, like I'm not involved with students on their on a day-to-day basis. And I wonder often to myself, like, are we really, you know, changing education is kind of a long game. It's not, you know, something you do overnight. And so that's what keeps me inspired, is just knowing that, you know, this is about the ultimate victory, not about the intermediate, you know, immediate wins. But yeah, it is challenging sometimes. I mean, I've done some things, you know, I haven't been teaching for the last 2 years, but, a couple of years ago, I, ran for and got a seat on my local school board to try and be a little bit closer to the, to students and to knowing what their needs are and trying to help out in that regard. But yeah, I think it's, you know, truth be told, you know, changing education isn't easy. It's why there's been decades of reform now, and we still haven't seen, you know, huge change. I think there's been a lot of progress along the way, but I think there's still a lot of work to be done, just because change is slow. And I think in many ways, you know, it's slow for a good reason. If we could blow up the education system overnight, you know, that would be a huge problem for a lot of students. We'd end up, you know, shaking up their lives in ways that probably wouldn't be good. So I think that inertia that keeps things the way they are is good in many ways, but it just means that change often takes time.
That's an interesting thought. You know, it's funny, and I want to talk about your research paper in a minute, but it's what drew me to that was the perspective you take on change from a teacher's point of view. And I've often thought that one of the problems, one of the reasons we don't see change happen, is because we cannot just blow up the system as it is. And I've often said, and I think even on the podcast before, I've said, you know, we might be better off if we did just let this thing burn to the ground and figure out what comes from the ashes, because we're not making change happen. But for you come up that from the perspective of, but if we did that, that would be real, real bad for a lot of kids. And I think that's an interesting perspective to take on that. And, sort of the positive of why change is slow is interesting. That's a good perspective.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've talked to tons of people. I have friends that will sit and debate all day about, you know, how should we change this or that in education? And truth be told, like, there's a lot of good ideas, but a lot of them, we just don't know if they're actually going to work till we try them. And the risk of, if we were to, you know, if there was a way to blow up the system, is that we'd try a lot of things. A lot of them would fail. Eventually we'd figure out some really good stuff, and in the long run we'd get to a much better place. But in the short run, while things are failing and while we're experimenting and trying to figure out what works, I think a lot of kids would slip through the cracks. So I'll say this is a little bit off topic from the research that you read that we're about to dive in on, but one of the core ideas from our institute is this idea of disruptive innovation. And I have to say up front, when we talk about disruptive innovation, it's probably different than what most people are picturing, because that term gets thrown around to mean like anything grand and big and radical and different. But when we talk about disruptive innovation, we're talking about innovations that start off outside of the mainstream context and really have a runway to improve themselves over time before they become mainstream. And so I guess that's one of the things that I found attractive and exciting about the work we do here at the Institute, is figuring out what are those opportunities to pilot ideas outside the mainstream, where you don't have to blow up the system and you have more freedom, but you're also not, you know, you don't have to worry about the risk of the impact you have on students, and then develop ideas in that context before they work into the mainstream over time.
Yeah, it's cool, because I always think about pilot programs and beta testing and things like that, especially in the educational space, as a necessary evil to get the data to prove something will work in the way you think or know it will. And you're coming at it from the perspective of it is necessary, but it is not evil. It's a necessary good to make sure that it is, you know, hitting people at the right speed and making sure. So I think that's a much more positive take on some of the struggles we deal with.
Yeah, well, that's the hope anyways, that it works out like that.
Yeah. So before I get to sort of my normal questions for my show, I do want to talk a little bit about your research. And the paper you wrote is called The Teacher's Quest for Progress, How School Leaders Can Motivate Instructional Innovation. And you wrote that with Bob Mosta and Michael Horn. Did I get that right?
Yeah, Bob Mosta and Michael Horn. Yep.
Awesome. And you take and correct me if I'm getting any summary of this wrong, but you guys look at the jobs to be done theory, which I'd actually heard of outside of the educational space before, where we basically sort of assume that anything you hire, buy, purchase, you know, eat, consume, whatever, you're getting to hire for a specific need. And you kind of apply that to instructional change. But what I think makes it so interesting is you imply it from a teacher's point of view and how a teacher looks at change. And I think most often when we talk about change, we talk about it from an administrative or leadership position and how to get teachers to buy into that change, as opposed to the why should teachers look at this change. Can you talk a little bit about that research?
Yeah. So really what prompted that strand of research was we had looked around at a lot of efforts, programs, initiatives at schools and school districts to do innovative practices, and seeing that a lot of them really flounder. Either they just struggle to even get off the ground, or maybe they can find a few teachers that pilot it and things look great, and then when they try to scale it more district-wide, it struggles. And, you know, our question was like, why does that happen? And our hunch or our hypothesis that led into this work was a sense that it's because a lot of times these programs are getting thrust on teachers. Teachers are being told, hey, this is our district's new thing, therefore you need to do it, and you're going to get evaluated against it, and your principal's going to be, you know, walking in and checking to make sure you do it, so you better do it. And that reason for doing it just isn't a great motivation, because it doesn't lead to the type of, you know, really creative problem solving that teachers have to do in order to make a practice really work for them. You know, because you can't, you know, truth be told, in education, it's part art, part science. And that means that you can't just give someone a checklist and say, do everything on this list and it's all going to work. Like, teachers have to bring their own creativity and their own problem solving to make anything work. And so, but if you don't have, you know, if teachers aren't motivated to do that on their own, programs often don't work out well. So anyway, so we thought, you know, this theory of jobs to be done, one, we can use the research method from jobs to be done to uncover and test, is this whole, is it true that many teachers feel just thrust into new programs rather than drawing those programs into their lives because they value them? And then from there, we can also figure out, well, what is it that does motivate teachers to change their practices? Because teachers change their practices all the time, regardless of whether anything's coming down from their district or their school leaders. Because teachers are constantly looking for, how do I solve the challenges that I'm facing in my classroom? And they're trying new strategies and new tools and new resources to solve those challenges. So the beauty of jobs theory is it comes in and the jobs to be done methodology doesn't ask them, well, what would you like in a new program? And ask them, tell me about a time when you made a switch, when you made a decision to change, and then tell me the story that led you there. And from that, we can uncover, what is the job that you were hiring for? And what is it that it will intrinsically motivate you to pull new practices into your classrooms? And so from there, then the hope is that people read this research and as they are thinking about, in particular school leaders, as they're thinking about programs that they want to push, they'll step back and say, wait a second, before I just start trying to sell this idea really hard, what are the jobs that my teachers are trying to get done? And how do I line up whatever I think is important with whatever they already value so that adoption will be organic, not something that we're trying to push really hard.
Yeah. And like you said, I love that it looks at finding that intrinsic motivation in teachers, and it accepts that teachers do adjust instructional strategy. I don't think many teachers, and even though sometimes in my work, it can feel like veteran teachers are stuck in the mud or maintaining the status quo and just sticking with what they've been doing, they have changed instructional practice over time. Certainly they must have. They can't still be actually be doing literally the same thing that they would have done 15, 20, 30 years ago. So there must be some amount of change. So there must have been something to motivate them to change at some point. And you guys, I think, do a great job in your research of sort of finding, you guys break it down into four sort of categories of reasons to hire an instructional change. And do you want to talk about those briefly? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, this gets into what were those specific jobs we saw when we interviewed teachers and asked them about why they were motivated to change. You know, the first one that we identify is help me lead the way in improving my school. So these are teachers who, they're often looking for how do I, you know, they want to be a part of a bigger cause. They don't just want to shut their classroom door and say, hey, leave me alone. I'm doing my work with my students. They're thinking big picture about like, how do I help my school and my community improve? And they also often, you know, they're looking for ways to advance themselves and demonstrate that they're really key team players to their schools. And so for them, you know, they're eager to get on board with an initiative that one seems like a compelling way to make the school improvement happen. And then also, seems like straightforward enough that they can see that idea getting, picked up by their colleagues in their building or at their grade level. So in other words, they don't want an idea. If the program comes down and it's like, hey, this is a great idea, but it's so complicated that, you know, only a few pilot teachers are going to do it. Those teachers with job number one aren't that interested because they're going to say like, you know, this isn't going to improve our school. This is just, you know, a niche offshoot program. But anyway, so if you design the initiative in a way that invites these teachers to step up, share their insight, share their expertise, shape the program, and help lead the way in improving their school, that gets those teachers on board. So that's job number one. Job number two, were teachers that were less interested in like the school-wide improvement initiative than were really just focused on their students. And so we call their job, you know, help me to engage my students in a way that's manageable. So, you know, these are teachers who on a day-to-day basis, by and large, like their classrooms go well. They've picked up a lot of strategies over the years that have worked for them. And they feel pretty confident in what they do, but they know that, you know, in a given semester, there's always one or two students who are slipping through the cracks, who just seem disengaged or who just really struggle to understand what they're trying to teach. Or it may be that, you know, in that same semester, there's like one or two lessons or a unit that just seem to flop and students don't really get it. So these teachers are looking for like, how do I improve those scenarios? How do I engage those one or two students that I'm not reaching? Or how do I improve those one or two lessons? So for them, you know, they're looking for new resources, but the key is that those resources have to be manageable. It has to be something that, you know, they can pick up and with a minimal amount of training or preparation, they can integrate these new strategies into the practices that are already working for them. In other words, they don't want, if you come in and tell them, hey, we've got this great thing that's going to do fantastic things for your kids, but you're going to have to go to 3 months of PD and then spend all summer like building new resources and throwing out everything you've done in the past, like that doesn't fly for them. It's, you know, help me engage my students, but do it in a way that just is manageable, that fits with what I've been doing in the past. And then the third job is a job that's interesting because in some ways it's similar to that second job, but in other ways it's really different. What's similar is that teachers with that third job are also really looking for how do I reach more of my students? How do I engage more of my students? But this third job really illustrates an important idea about jobs, and that is jobs aren't really, they're not based on personality. It's not that people with certain personalities have certain jobs. Jobs are really defined more by the circumstances people find themselves in that cause them to feel a struggle that leads them to want to find something new and to change whatever they've been doing in the past. And the struggle for job three teachers is that they're teaching in settings where teaching feels broken, where day in, day out, they are frustrated because, you know, for them, maybe it's the whole class seems disengaged or the whole class doesn't seem to get the material. Or it could be something where, yeah, students are doing fine on a day-to-day basis, but they know that lots of their students after graduation are struggling in college or aren't even applying to college. And they're thinking to themselves, you know, what's the point? Like, what I'm doing isn't working. What, am I even making a difference? So for these teachers, that difference in their circumstances and their struggles primes them to say, you know, I don't want just the manageable new best practice or new strategy that'll make my teaching that much better so that I can reach one or few students. They're thinking to themselves, you know, help me reinvent my instructional model. It's not working. I'm ready for something radically different. And in fact, many of them told us, like, I don't want another set of best practices because I've been to plenty of PD sessions where they've gave me, you know, some new strategy or some new tool that sounds nice, but it really doesn't address the bigger issues that I'm wrestling with. So don't give me some new best practice. Like, give me a radically different instructional model. So, you know, step back a little bit now from these jobs. One of our big insights from this research is that different programs are going to appeal to different teachers depending on their jobs. For a teacher with job two, you know, you want a program that integrates nicely into what they've been doing in the past. But for a teacher with job three, that's not going to fly. So usually for job three teachers, those are the ones where you want to say, okay, let's step outside of the tradition, you know, the mainstream school context and find maybe, you know, a remedial course or an elective course that we haven't offered in the past, or like a tutoring program or an after-school program, some context where we can give you the freedom to experiment and let you go off and try things that are way different than traditional teaching. And then just to round things out, the fourth job we identified was really not a job in the sense that it's a job that doesn't exist in teachers' lives until the school leader comes down with a new program. The teacher looks at that program and says, this doesn't do any job that I'm interested in. It doesn't do job one, two, or three. Therefore, you're going to create a new job for me that essentially comes down to help me not fall behind on my school's program because I don't want to stand out as being the one who's not a team player. So I'm going to go along with it. And, you know, if it's, you know, a new technology initiative, I'll roll the technology carts into my classroom and I'll, you know, check the box that I'm doing this twice a week if that's what's required of me. But I'm not thinking big picture about how does this help me and help my students. I'm just thinking about how do I make sure I'm not getting, you know, getting dinged for not doing what I'm supposed to. And again, this is what I alluded to in the very beginning of our conversation, but one of our big takeaways is like school leaders need to do everything they can to avoid pushing teachers into that job. If you don't draw teachers in through one of the other jobs and you push them into something through that fourth job, you're just not setting that program up for very good success.
Yeah, it's funny. And, you know, I listen to a lot of education podcasts and I hear a lot of theories and models and research and everything else. And when I heard yours, it spoke to me so much. And it did that thing that sometimes happens where you're going through the jobs and I'm like picturing teachers in my head. Oh, one yeah. is this person and two is this person and three is this entire department over here and four is. And it's interesting how much that connects directly to what we do. And it's awesome. The one thing I'm curious about in your research, and I get it. I think it's great. I love connecting the jobs to be done theory, which is well beyond education, but I think it's great, connecting that to what we do. And you talk about how we want instructional leaders to use this to help them plan. But at the same time, I kind of feel like some of the jobs contradict each other. Now, we don't want to push people into four, but, you know, you kind of even say in your summary that job one and job three kind of contradict each other in the sense that you kind of have to do a drastic change for a job three person, but the job one person just wants to lead the change. How can we sort of, or should we try to meet all three jobs with the same new initiative we're trying to push out?
Well, I think that's what you've just pointed out is like a really key insight from this research, which is that a single initiative isn't going to be all things to all people. And school leaders need to recognize that, or program leaders need to recognize that. So our general recommendation there is, you know, think of the different jobs you have amongst your staff and, you know, either, you know, create the program in a way that's optional so that it can draw in the people that it meets a job for and doesn't force in the people who it doesn't meet a job for, or potentially create, you know, multiple programs, you know, one program designed really to meet the jobs of, say, teachers with job one and job two, and a separate program for those teachers with job three. You know, because, you know, I think that's a key insight is that if you try and make a program that's all things to all people, it's just not going to meet all the jobs because some of the jobs do seem contradictory. Now that being said, we have seen though in the research too, that people's jobs do shift over time. depending on their context and their circumstances. So, you know, if you find, if a school is in a situation where they say, hey, we, you know, we can't make this optional. We can't just do it for some people, or we can't have multiple programs for different people. You know, the next best thing is to figure out how do you change people's circumstances to activate a job that they're really not drawn to initially. So for example, one of the teachers we interviewed was a kindergarten teacher who had been teaching. She started her career teaching, then she left teaching for a while to raise her kids, and then came back to teaching. And when she hired back on at a new school after that time away, that school was already 2 or 3 years into a blended learning initiative. And she came in and she's like, I didn't have a lot of computer savvy, had never used technology in her classroom before. I was just frustrated. And it was like, what is this doing? You know, how is this valuable for my students? And so initially she was squarely in job four. She was only doing it because she felt like she had to. She didn't want her students to fall behind the other kids in the school because they weren't learning how to use the technology. But over time, she shifted to more of a job two perspective where, you know, as she used the technology, she saw how it helped her differentiate her instruction better. And as she got support from her district and professional development, it lowered a lot of her anxieties about using that technology. And so, you know, with the right support and with feeling some early successes with that new set of practices and technologies, it brought her to a place where she saw that program as a way to fulfill job two for her. So, you know, I think there's kind of two prongs to what we recommend. One is align your programs with the jobs that already exist amongst your staff. But if you can't do that, then find ways to activate different jobs amongst your staff by changing the circumstances they're in to help make different jobs relevant that maybe haven't been relevant in the past.
I like that. I like the idea. Another thing I like about it is that it is not a rigid structure, and that you mentioned that jobs can change over time. And I feel like with a lot of our initiatives, even when we look at it from a teacher centric, it's identifying the types of people that are in our building and how we address those types of people. And this is very much addressing the needs. And I think that's a really cool way, and that those needs can change over time, that they are flexible and they are dependent upon the scenario is interesting to me. And it also means even if you're, you know, and I think at all times, any school is running more than one initiative, no matter what your primary initiative, there's probably a lot of other things going on. And it kind of points to the fact that different teachers will own different initiatives more directly and more primarily than others. And it helps sort of describe why some of those priorities are there. And I think it's just a really interesting framework. And I would definitely encourage my audience to check it out. I shouldn't say framework, but interesting research. And I definitely encourage my audience to check it out. I do have links to the paper in my show notes, so you can always look at those there. It is cool. I think it's great. I know I'm going to be pushing it out to my leadership team to have us all take a look at it as we think about initiatives we're running on a campus. Cause it's cool. I like it a lot.
Cool. Well, I'm excited to hear that it's insightful and helpful, and thanks for helping get the word out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to move into sort of the, you know, I don't normally have researchers on my show and do this portion of it. So this has kind of been a unique experience for both me and I'm sure my audience. But I want to talk a little more about sort of big picture stuff and how education is across the whole. And I'm really interested in your perspective as an educational researcher and someone who does this kind of work on a regular basis with your work with the Christian Institute. And so I want to go to my first normal question that I would ask all my guests. And my first question is always, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
That's a big question.
It is.
I would say that the biggest problem in education is that there are students slipping through the cracks because education in many instances isn't lined up with what they need. Either what they need individually to help them feel successful, or what they need big picture to be successful outside of the school system when they move on through it. So, you know, for example, you know, if you're a teacher, you know that in any given class, I mean, if you're doing your job well, hopefully most of your students are engaged and enjoying what you're doing. But there's always students who are either bored because they are, you know, advanced or accelerated, and it's hard to know how to challenge them. And at the same time, there's students who come in lost because they, you know, for one reason or another, they haven't picked up what they needed to pick up before they got to your class. And as a teacher, it's really hard to meet those needs. And as a student, I think that's actually what leads to a lot of, you know, students feeling frustrated or feeling anxious or feeling disengaged or feeling motivated to act out in schools, that they feel like, you know, they're being asked to conform to a system that doesn't meet their individual needs. So, you know, I think teachers do some pretty tremendous and heroic work, you know, getting to know their students, getting to know those needs, but ultimately, you know, the way education's set up, it's just hard to do that and to do it really well day in, day out for all your students.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely can see that. I mean, obviously in a given classroom, you know, we've been refocusing, on Rick DeForest's PLC model in my school. And it points me back to those, you know, his four questions, which are, you know, what do we want them to learn? How do we know when they learn it? But then the two other questions, which are, what do we do if they already know it? And what do we do if they don't get it? You know, and it by nature means that there are different groups of students. And we should be coming up with a way to reach every single one of those, but time gets in the way. And like you said, the structure, I have a class of 25 students and I can't possibly differentiate for all 25 of them every single lecture, every single day, every single unit. And so I think that, yeah, structurally that makes it really, really hard. What is the solution there? Like, what do we need to be doing that we're not doing? And I don't mean teachers necessarily. I think I agree with you that teachers are doing the best they can. But as a whole, what do we need to be doing that we're not doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'd say there's a bunch of different avenues that lead to the solutions. And in fact, the solution to this problem is multifaceted. There's not like one thing that solves the whole problem. It's a lot of different things. But I think, you know, one piece of it is creating the context where we can develop new instructional models that are better at meeting those individual needs. So in our research, you know, I've seen some schools that do really interesting stuff where by leveraging the advantages of online learning, they let teachers provide students with more individualized learning plans, and then also create more time for teachers to engage with their students on a personal level. You know, so one student in particular, or one school in particular that I'm coming to mind, you know, they shifted their instructional model where they put a lot of their learning resources online and basically created a system where students could log in and see, okay, here's my learning plan for the next semester or the next year. And then students may spend part of the day like working with teachers, working with their peers, on things where, you know, it's valuable to do group activities or, you know, to get some face-to-face instruction with teachers to really troubleshoot some misconceptions. But part of the day, the students are engaging with learning resources on their own in a way that's tailored to their individual needs. And what that does for the teachers, really, you know, the teachers in this school I visited, they talk about how this model lets them actually do what they got into teaching for in the first place, because with the teachers, because they're not spending all day delivering period after period of structured lesson plans, teachers spend a lot more of their time tutoring or meeting with students one-on-one. And they have a mentorship program set up where, you know, they'll have a student who is in a high school. They'll mentor a student for 4 years straight and really get to know the student's interests and their family and their circumstances. And that personal connection that teachers are able to make because you know, some of the direct instruction is taken off their plate by technology, really frees them up. So I think, you know, one solution is we've got to find the space and the creativity within districts to experiment and figure out these types of models that can free things up. But, you know, I'll say another thing too, and this last one probably varies depending on what state you're in, but I think just the overall level of funding in education is often a challenge. I'm in California, and, you know, I would say that that, you know, our schools in many ways struggle just to have the basic resources they need to operate their programs. So, and to pay their teachers salaries that can attract and retain, you know, teachers. So I think part of it is a funding solution. Part of it is a creativity within the district. And then the last piece would be policy that can accept, you know, new instructional approaches. So, you know, schools that are doing really interesting stuff often run into barriers where the state says, well, you have to have so many hours of instructional time, and, you know, what you're doing doesn't count for those hours. Or they'll say, you know, you have to do your students' grades in a certain way so that it lines up with the state graduation requirements or the university admission requirements. And so it's those pushback from the structures outside of the school often can be a challenge. So anyway, there's a bunch more that we could probably dig in on, and I think those are just to name the highlights, but I think those are some of the pieces that matter.
Oh, you mentioned earlier that you ran for and were on the school board for your area. Do you feel like, and I've had a school board member on my show before and had a long conversation with her about this, but do you feel like it, in your experience at least, that it is a local school board, a district school board, or is it, do the problems, at least in terms of expectations that you mentioned at the end there, is your local school board to blame, or does the issue go higher than that?
Well, I don't think local school boards are necessarily to blame, but I think that the dynamic in the relationship between the school board, the members on the board, and the district staff can either hurt or hinder a lot of important practices and innovations. So, you know, to try and be a little more specific on that, you know, school board members have a valuable role to play in that they, you know, they're elected by the community to look after the best interests of their students and make sure that the district, you know, doesn't have issues of fraud or embezzlement, make sure that the district isn't, you know, woefully underserving certain student groups. You know, so part of it is like, you know, just that monitor to make sure the school system isn't operating badly. But I think for most school systems, that's not the case. That's not actually the main concern, because most schools are doing a decent job at what they do. Instead, you know, they really need to come together and figure out, you know, how can we support vision and innovation for doing, figuring out better approaches in our schools. But if the school board members get locked into the politics of, and the contention of politics, sometimes that politics gets in the way, and the superintendent either feels handcuffed in their ability to do things because they don't think the board will approve it, or they feel like they have to do anything that's interesting has to fly under the radar because it's going to become a controversial issue for their board. So, you know, I guess what I saw from my experience is that, you know, if you can get a board to come together and say, okay, we're going to debate things rigorously, and we're going to, you know, float a lot of ideas, but at the end of the day, we respect each other and we can work together to come to consensus on what would be some good approaches for our students. And if you have a superintendent who can help manage the board and lead the board and build trust with the board to where the board feels confident in the superintendent's work, you can do some great things. But without that trust, you can just get mired in the politics of school boards in a way that keeps things just churning along the way they've always gone, because it's too hard to fight the politics to do anything different.
Yeah, I like that. That's a insightful look there. So I appreciate that. Didn't really plan on going there, but it just occurred to me that you mentioned
it. It's a whole interesting other topic there. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I've definitely got questions about that as well. So I want to go to my next question. I definitely see where you're coming from in terms of, you know, students slipping through the cracks and needing I think you said multifaceted solution. And I agree wholeheartedly that it is not so simple as to one problem, one solution, despite the fact that that's what I ask all of my guests to give me on a regular basis. but I agree with you that it is a very complex problem. And I like the solutions you've provided. I do worry that some of those more innovative and off-the-wall solutions are not scalable to a full district level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of like you said earlier about how, you know, we test something out in a small market or in a small group or a beta testing group, is it's valuable, but I don't know that that data can always be applied in a full scenario or in a full range scenario. You know, we see that charter schools have interesting results, to say the least, and, you know, however you may feel about them, but their results cannot always be replicated in a public school setting for a myriad of reasons. So I worry a little bit about that, but I definitely agree that we need some innovative change. We need something big and drastic to look at some of these major issues. You know, you talk about students falling through the cracks, and I think that our cracks are real, real big, and it's easy for them to fall through sometimes. So I think it's a tremendous challenge. So, but I do appreciate your perspective on that. But I do want to also ask you my second question, which my second question for all my guests may actually address some of the same issues or not. My second question for all my guests is, what is something you're doing that you wish all teachers would do?
That's a good question. Since I'm not currently teaching, I have to go out and what have I seen that's valuable in some of the research and some of the schools we visited. But, you know, I would say, I think teachers should spend some time thinking about technology in their classroom from a different lens. I think often some of the lenses that are more common is to look at technology and say, okay, either I don't like technology because it's complicated and it's frustrating to figure out, or another common one is I'm worried that the people pushing technology are just trying to replace me as a teacher and take me out of the picture. Or the ones that are more technology favorable often look at it as like, okay, how can I make this lesson more engaging using the technologies I have available to me? But I want to say first off, like from the research I've done, it's pretty clear to me that technology cannot replace teachers. You know, there's the hypothetical possibility out there where we get, you know, generalizable AI where we have robots that look and act and think just like people. If we get to that world, then maybe, yeah, technology could replace teachers. But I think there's a whole host of like other societal problems we'll be dealing with if we get to that place. But in the near term, and I'm skeptical if we'll even get that, well, I'm skeptical if we'll ever get there with technology. But in the near term, I don't think we will. And so I don't think teachers have much to worry about as, you know, along the lines of, is the technology going to replace me? But I think where teachers often, just a vein of technology they're not thinking about is, how can the technology free me up from some of the things I do so I can spend my time on the things that matter most for my students? Because often, sometimes that challenges the notion of what it means to be a teacher. Because maybe that means flipping your classroom, and instead of giving a really great lesson every day, you develop videos or you find resources online to cover the core content in your class. And then you have students access that online, either at home or some other sitting outside of your classroom. You know, that can be challenging for a teacher because I think, like, my job is to teach. If I'm not leading the lesson and delivering the lesson, it doesn't feel like I'm doing my job. But if you switch the paradigm and you don't think about, like, you know, am I supposed to be in the front of the room? Is that my job as a teacher? Instead, you think of, my job is to have the biggest impact I can with my students. And if I can take some of that, like, lesson delivery off of my plate and offload it onto technology, then I can focus on the things that really matter, like coaching my students on projects or sitting down with them to give them the real human feedback they need that you can't get from a computer. So, for example, like, you know, a computer can grade a multiple choice test, but it can't tell you things like, you know, your teamwork skills or your creative problem solving skills. It can't give you that kind of feedback. So if you can offload the basic kind of feedback of, you know, are you solving this problem, math problem correctly, or did you, you know, remember the right way to the right list of the DNA sequence, the proteins in the DNA sequence. Let the technology teach and give students feedback on that basic, like, depth of knowledge level 1 or 2 type of stuff, so that you as the teacher can then say, know, I'm going to work on projects and work in small groups with my students and give them one-on-one feedback or small group feedback and really deepen my relationship with those students. I think that's often where I think teachers are sometimes missing the opportunity to see how can I offload things onto technology so I can do what's most valuable in that scarce time I have with my students each day.
I just want to be like, amen, absolutely. You know, it's funny to me, you kind of before this actually touched on the idea of a flipped classroom. And it's, I thought of that at the time. It's funny to me how often we can recognize the value of that. We can talk about how great it would be to have more time to work one-on-one with our students or work in small groups. And yet every time that me or an administrator in my school goes in to sort of observe a teacher, they always pick a day where they're up front, where they're mm-hmm. talking to the class. And I will often hear those kind of lecture driven teachers who depend on that. They'll say that whole, well, they're trying to use the technology to replace me. Mm-hmm. And what I always find hilarious about that is the kind of teaching they're doing is the one that would be easiest to replace with technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I can record you and just repeat you for the rest of time. That's not hard to do. A yep. video camera could have done that in the 70s. We didn't yep. need modern technology to do. And yet the parts of the job that are so much more than just that, that are the human aspect, that are the direct connection to students, that is the one-on-one or the one-on-three scenarios where you're working with students and reacting to where they're at, that's the stuff that they never invite us in to see as their moment to shine, or at least rarely do anymore. Yeah. And I'm starting to see that paradigm shift, as you said, but you know, it is true. I 100% agree with you. Let the technology get rid of the part that it can get rid of. Let the technology replace you in some fashion so that you can work on the other things that it can't do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the way you said it is so well put of, you know, if all you do as a teacher is, you know, give out multiple choice tests and give lectures, like you are replaceable. So focus on the things that aren't replaceable and let the technology do that. I think absolutely you've said it so well.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Thank you. That's excellent. I like that answer. I don't even really have to like dive deeper into that one. I feel like you nailed it. You laid it out there right there. I can just sort of preach. Amen. Next question. Not that that's good radio because that's a terrible transition, but I'm going to do it anyways. And we've been talking for a while. So I do want to go ahead. I have one last question I ask all my guests, and I do want to go ahead and ask you that one. And here's where we get to get a little more personal. My last question for all my guests is, who is the greatest teacher you have ever had?
You know, I would say Jim Johnson, who was my ninth grade English teacher. So I have to say, I was not a big fan of English in middle school and high school. I didn't enjoy writing, which is super ironic because that's all I do for my job now is write, or a big part of my job at least. Anyway, I attribute a lot of, you know, my abilities now stemmed from that class. And what really made the difference was, one, he was super interesting. Like, he just, you know, had a sense of humor, had a way to talk excitedly about things like Shakespeare and Hemingway that made me more interested than I otherwise would have been. But also he was like, he gave me hard feedback. I remember that was a class where every once a month we had to do an essay on a book we had read. And it wasn't just a book report. It was like an analysis where you had to dissect the themes in the book, or draw parallels between the book and the historical context that it was in. And those were some of the most grueling assignments I had because he graded them so hard. But I will say the feedback he gave was really what developed me as a writer. It was struggling to understand what he was trying to teach me that really taught me how to write.
It's interesting. So often, when I ask that question, it's not nearly as content specific. Yours is so, it's interesting. Very rarely do I get someone that focuses on, a teacher's ability to actually teach things. So that's kind of a refreshing thing there. But even still, you're talking about the feedback component and that, and you know, it still is that human component, that thing that we still can't necessarily get a machine to do is look and give genuine real feedback on something. It can, you know, formulaically recognize flaws in structure and things like that, but it can't give that kind of feedback that can directly connect with and have a true impact on a person, I don't believe.
Yeah. Well, let me fill in and say too, you know, part of what made that teacher great was, you know, he pushed me as a student, but I could also tell that, like, he cared about me. And he gave me challenges because he had a confidence I could step up into him. And I think I missed that in the first part of it. But I think it was that, it's that person-to-person connection with the teacher that I think makes the instruction happen well. So.
I love it. I love every bit of it. I feel like this has been an excellent discussion, Thomas. I genuinely appreciate you being on the show. Like I've said, I love your work with, you know, the teaching jobs, and I really do appreciate you joining me on the podcast. Could you, for my audience, if they would like to get a hold of you, could you give them how could they reach out to you? I should say.
Well, if you go to the ChristensenInstitute.org, I know that's a super long URL. But we've got an about page that has our whole team on there, and you can look me up there and you can find my email address and how to contact me that way. So that's ChristensenInstitute.org, or you can just search for Christensen Institute on Google and you'll find it. The other one, I love when people engage on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is @ArnettTom or @ArnettTom. So 3 T's in a row, @ArnettTom. And, you know, love it if people shoot me questions, Even if they want to challenge some of the ideas, I think that discussion is worthwhile. So, please feel free to reach out or to engage.
All right. Absolutely. And links to all those, of course, will be in the show notes. So you can slide on over to those and you will be able to see all direct links to all those. So you don't have to try to figure out how to spell Christensen of what, you know, the 17 different ways I can think of to spell it off the top of my head. So links are directly there in the show notes. And Thomas, generally, I really do appreciate you joining me on the show. I thought we had a great talk. So thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. No, great chat. I really enjoyed the opportunity to be on the show with you, Brad. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thomas, thank you again for being on the show. You bring a great perspective to the conversation, really to every question I ask, an interesting perspective, and I really enjoyed it. To connect with Thomas, go to ChristensenInstitute.org, and you can find information about him on the About page, or check out Tom on Twitter. He's @ArnettTom. Links to both of those, of course, are in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm @BradShreffler, and I love to hear from you guys. It's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or check out the feedback page on my website, which gives you options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradshreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, think about the jobs you need done. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.